Today on Against the Grain, socialist Yugoslavia was born out of resistance to fascist occupation during World War II and ended up in dismemberment and civil war. Today, Yugoslavia's demise is much better remembered than what came before it. Yet socialist Yugoslavia forged a different path from that of the Soviet Union and experimented with a form of workers' self-management, which was hailed at the time across the international left from progressives to anarchists. I'm Sasha Lilly. Radical educator Andrei Gribicic reflects on socialist Yugoslavia's history, achievements, and contradictions. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Is there anything to be salvaged from the experience of actually existing communism in the 20th century? To look at the crimes that took place in the Soviet Union and China, of famine, state repression, and surveillance, it would seem like the answer should be a resounding no. But is it accurate to assume that there was actually little variation between the countries that called themselves communist or socialist? What about socialist Yugoslavia, which broke with the Soviet bloc and made its own way? Largely forgotten now, in the 1960s, much of the international left was enamored of the Yugoslav socialist experiment, including the centrality of workers' self-management. To reflect on that history is Andrei Gribicic, who grew up in socialist Yugoslavia, where he ultimately encountered the anarchist writings that shaped his own view of the Yugoslav experience. He's the chair of the Department of Anthropology and Social Change at the California Institute of Integral Studies and the author of a number of books, which include Don't Mourn, Balkanize, Essays After Yugoslavia, which was published by PM Press. I should say that I have a connection to PM Press. Andrei, what were the origins of Yugoslavia out of the ashes of empire?
Well, I think we contributed positively to the end of the empire. And this is something that I think is very controversial among the historians who are still writing absolutely inane books like Sleepwalkers and similar books about the end of the empire, bemoaning the end of the great Austro-Hungarian Empire and blaming a very young idealist who was also an anarchist and one of the founding members of a group called Mlada Bosna, or Young Bosnia, and his name was Gavrilo Princip. He famously executed a tyrant whose name was Archduke Ferdinand, not a very bright fellow, you know, these people often are not, but in certain sense politically significant, and his death or assassination was used by great powers in order to instigate the First World War. Out of the ashes of this First World War that allegedly started with a gunshot of Gavrilo Princip and his act, Yugoslavia, or First Kingdom of Serbs, Croatians and Slovenes, was born after the peace in Versailles. But even that shot, and I think it's important to mention this, of Gavrilo Princip came out of a certain idea. It wasn't really the bullet. It was what was really important there was that Young Bosnia was an anti-colonial organization and merging out of occupied Bosnia and Herzegovina, occupied by Austro-Hungarian Empire and previously by Ottoman Empire, and comprised of Yugoslavs, of people who were already developing a pan-ethnic idea or Yugoslav idea of living together. And this includes both or all Muslims, Croatians and Serbs, not all of them, but they were a mixed organization, of course, with a certain penchant for anarchist literature, Russian populist literature. Stepniak was famously involved in many of these, and many other revolutionaries. Kropotkin was very influential. So there was an interesting mix, melange of different ideas that Yugoslav Bolsheviks, when Yugoslavia became a communist country, tried to read in a key that was friendly to the Yugoslav Communist Party and Yugoslav communist experience, which is going to happen only after the Yugoslav Communist Revolution, which took place between 1941 and 1945, as a response to the Nazi invasion and as a result of what we call in Yugoslavia the partisan national liberation war.
Well, tell us a bit more about the significance of this idea of a movement that spanned these different divisions. Certainly reading back from history, from the present backwards, we are often told that the region of the Balkans has for centuries been embroiled in inter-ethnic hatreds and the breakup of Yugoslavia, which we'll get to as the program goes on, can be read, we are told, through this light of everyone, all these different people at each other's throats. I know you reject that telling of history, and I wonder if you can talk about the significance of the notion of a pan-Slavism in terms of both that and also in terms of thinking about movements that go beyond the nation state.
Oh, wow, that's a serious question. Yes, I do reject that interpretation of history, which usually rests on the assumption, well, two. One is a racialized assumption that we in the Balkans just tend to kill each other every now and then for no reason, apparent reason whatsoever, which I think needs to be supplanted, and in serious scholarship it mostly is, by a materialist theory of ethnic conflict. And the other is this idea that is a part of the similar arsenal of ideas that Yugoslavia was somehow artificial. So it wasn't really a result of several centuries of struggle, both on the territory, so to speak, of thought and theory, as in political action, but somehow it emerged out of the head of few idealists who then imposed this conception onto the rest of the population. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Yugoslavia was not an artificial construction. Yugoslavia did come, and I'm glad that you mentioned pan-Slavism. Pan-Slavism, pan-Slavic tradition is a difficult one, very complex, very nuanced. As you know, some of the most important leftist revolutionaries like Bakunin for a while were pan-Slavist. And it comprised all sorts of interesting dialogues between different fractions that emerged around the notion of pan-Slavism. If you look at any of the flags of Slav nations, you will see the similar variation of colors. The old Yugoslav socialist nationalist anthem was called Hey Slavs. So there are many elements, and there's a particular articulation of left-wing, so something that we would call progressive or even radical, with pan-Slavic tradition. And the one that I'm close to politically, intellectually, but also as a historian or sociologist interested in these things, is a particular populist current around a man whose name was Svetozar Marković, who lived in the 19th century and who is widely recognized as the founder of Balkan socialism. Now, what interests me greatly in his work was first around his journal, which was what we call in Yugoslavia or Eastern Europe, and we can talk a little bit more about this later, Thick Journal, which was invented by the Russians in 19th century. Vissarion Belinsky is the famous champion of thick journals, which were literally journals with social overtones. So Radenik, or The Worker, was Svetozar Marković's thick journal. And the interesting thing about that whole series that Jovan Skerlić, another important figure, continued later, is that it proposed both a particular kind of global radicalism based on the combination of ideas of Serbian, authentic, shall we say, indigenous, communal organizations, Marxism, and, of course, anarchism. So this particular, and I should also say Russian radical democracy around Chernyshevsky. So particular articulation of these influences created or pushed young Svetozar Marković, who was executed at the tender age of 28, and hailed as a saint by peasants surrounding him. Serbia in those days was a peasant country, mostly rural society. And what was so important about this is his idea of Balkan Federation. And now we are departing somewhat from the idea of Slavdom, because this included part of Turkey and also the entire Greece, the idea is that Balkan Federation should be built from below, but it should also be, and in the light of recent interventions from Rojava, from Kurdish countries, Abdullah Öcalan famously from prison, there is a certain affinity of ideas across generations and across decades, really centuries, which insists on creation of a stateless, democratic, confederalist or federalist solution that would be territorially based. So the first expression that I'm familiar of, in this part of the world at least, is Svetozar Marković. So this part of Yugoslav, early Yugoslav or early Balkan, idea or project is something that I'm still very close to. And I think that Balkan socialism in its first iteration, which unfortunately by later communist historians was deemed to be utopian or too utopian, I think that it wasn't. I think that it was extremely far-sighted. And on the basis of Svetozar Marković and his work on socialism and socialism in the Balkans, everything else was really developed. Yugoslav Communist Party, and before that Yugoslav Social Democracy, and before that Serbian Social Democracy, they were all built on different forms of engagement with the work of this seminal figure, whose name again is Svetozar Marković, and whose journal, thick journal, was Radenik, or The Worker.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about your own background, mm-hmm. your own family, and the politics that your grandparents had, and to what degree they were representative of a generation of people who ended up bringing socialist Yugoslavia into existence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I am blessed and cursed, or blessed or cursed, with a very interesting family story. Yes, both grandparents on both sides were involved quite essentially, fundamentally, and gave their lives for the project of socialist Yugoslavia. And they were members of the Communist Party, or the later became League of Communists of Yugoslavia, Yugoslav Communists. But they were in jail before the war. They attended the so-called Red Universities, where everybody read Marx. They escaped police torture, or they suffered police torture. They, after the war, and one of my grandfather on my father's side was tortured in the Titoist gulag, so gulag that was created for people who were against Cominform break, who believed in Stalinism and who believed in the Stalinist path to communism, Stalinist project. He was tortured to death, and he died from the consequences of torture, while the other grandfather emerged as one of the founders of the non-aligned movement, one of the, I would say, the fourth phase in the Yugoslav Communist Revolution. Another partisan hero and a person who was actually second in command after Tito for a while. He was the vice president of Yugoslavia until he got ill and he was replaced by other people. But he was famously met Che Guevara, very disappointed in Che's adventurism, banditism, he used to say, his inability of Che to actually understand what it means to create a socialist communist state and not just run to Angola and do whatever Che was doing in Angola. So all of this, I grew up with these conversations, and they created, you know, this was the background of my childhood. And in a certain sense, the way all of these conversations with my grandparents, especially perhaps my grandmother's, created the possibility for me to engage with different alternatives to all the things that went wrong in this particular interpretation of Yugoslav communism, that following the Stalinist experience, but then breaking with Stalinist experience, created this truly unique experience that we can call Yugoslav communism.
Well, let's talk about that. What were the circumstances under which socialist Yugoslavia was established? And what were the dominant intellectual currents that fed into that project?
Throughout the 30s, there were many thick journals keep coming back to those, that represented different ways that intellectuals and party politicians, like Tito, who became the leader of the Yugoslav communists, and, for example, Miroslav Krleža, who became the probably the best-known communist intellectual in Yugoslavia, but official communist intellectual, tremendously gifted, talented Croatian writer. In 1930s, he published, 1939, I think it was Dialectical Anti-Barbarous, was his famous, in one particular thick journal called Petrat, which means the stamp. The party immediately responded with something that was called a response, and in another thick journal called Knjižene sveske, which would be literally notebooks. And in these beautiful exchanges, of course, beautiful, they were hiding a very important and painful struggle for leadership within the Yugoslav Communist Party, which Tito finally was able to manage and to win, and I would say to Stalin's displeasure, and I would say great Stalin's displeasure. This created a possibility for a unified partisan struggle created and led and facilitated by communists. What they did, and organizing during the Second World War in Yugoslavia is a very important part of Yugoslav history. I would say that Yugoslav communism went through four phases. The first phase was the National Liberation War, and I'm now translating from Yugoslav, which was partisan, but which was based in very patient organizing throughout the territory. And it was built in local anti-fascist councils and also so-called people's committees, and then incipient elements of the government that was created in 1943.
And this is against the Nazi invasion?
Against the Nazi invasion, I would say during the Nazi invasion. So there was a tremendous effort of organizing and mobilizing people throughout these local organizations. So none of these things, again, an important historical lesson, I think, is spontaneous in that sense. Painful, patient organizing. My grandfathers on both sides were very instrumental in this process. And grandmothers, although one ended up in a concentration camp where she gave birth to my father, but it's another painful story. But in any case, that was the first stage. The second stage, I would say, comes after the break with Cominform, when we were kicked out.
The Cominform being
the organization of Stalin's led organization of what became known as the Second World of the Communist State.
Right, or the Soviet bloc.
The Soviet bloc. So we were expelled from the Soviet bloc in 1948. That created a great shock and massive reorientation of Yugoslav socialism that will result in third and fourth phase of Yugoslav revolution. The third was this internal reorganization around the idea of self-management. Autogestion or autogestion goes by different names, but Yugoslavia is the only country, to my knowledge, where socialist self-management was implemented and over the decades put into serious practice. The fourth element is the foundation, mostly by Yugoslav communists, of the non-aligned movement. So these four stages in the development of Yugoslav revolution were really important, but also, if you think about each one of these moments, they were profound shocks, disruptions, moments when Yugoslav communists completely lost their bearings in a certain sense, because before the Second World War, during the Second World War, and I would say up until 1950s at least, Yugoslavia was still based, Yugoslav communists were still based on what we used to call diamat. I don't know if this means anything.
Dialectical materialism, a phrase Stalin invented.
And it was just so much more than a phrase, because it was an orientation of that combined a very crude determinism and metaphysics. And it was something that many philosophical schools in Yugoslavia are going to continue to develop. The last journal was Dialectica, created after 1960s, after the famous Blade conference in Slovenia, but we can talk about this.
So this is ultra-dogmatic lens for looking at history or the present.
Exactly. It's the positive, productive, it's the development of the productive base that, of course, then through what we used to call reflection theory, creates the superstructure and all of that. Basically, it was based on the reflection theory. And then this crude, interpretation of Marx's ideas, Marx and Engels' ideas, was dominant. And still in 1948, 1950, Yugoslav communists created this crash collectivization of rural collectivization that was very much Stalinist in its tone, and it had to be reversed 5 years later. So Vladimir Dedier, who is one of the very close friend with Noam Chomsky, and also of my family, who's suffered a great deal of consequences for being a dissident and originally Tito's biographer, he used to say, we need to show that we are still real communists with our deeds, with our actions. And then he, in 1949 or 1950, he said, well, we were still very crude Stalinist in the way that we were responding to this. So what I'm trying to say is there was a need for a new orientation.
Let's just back up for one moment before we get to that. So can you explain, and I should say that I'm speaking with Andrei Grubicic. He's a historian and sociologist, chair of the Department of Anthropology and Social Change at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And today we're talking about the history of Yugoslav socialism. So one thing that did allow, propel, reorient the socialist project in Yugoslavia was the ultimate distance from the Soviet Union.
Absolutely.
Because first under Stalin and then his successors, the Soviet very much shaped the politics of the countries in Eastern Europe. What were the circumstances that led to Yugoslavia being expelled from the Soviet bloc?
Yugoslavs were completely right. The idea that what Stalin was trying to do was denounced very early on without, and this is interesting, a serious theoretical foundation in alternative ways of understanding what actually happened. Yugoslavs, and the first one to do it was the famous dissident and one of my least favorite figures in Yugoslav history, a future reactionary Milovan Djilas. The first reaction...
Who wrote the new class about bureaucratism.
Exactly. But and you're absolutely right. This actually was the main thing. Djilas, in 1949, I think, was the first in the party organ called the Communist, or just the Communist. He published the first formal distancing of Yugoslav political party, Communist Party, from Soviet Union, and he said he accused Soviet Union, and accusing Soviet Union was not small feat, of hegemonism and of disrupting the equality of socialist states. He actually called the Soviet Union imperialist, which was really, really interesting. Moshe Piade, the venerable theorist of Yugoslav communism, agreed with him. And then in the last instance, in the same year and in the same newspaper, Edvard Kardelj, who was the founding figure in many ways of Yugoslav self-management, the great synthesizer, he said, well, yeah, but there is also a continuation between hegemonism of Soviet Union, imperialism, and their internal structure and organization, which was completely bureaucratic. Now, in those days, Djilas and Kardelj would not go that far to say or to analyze the class society in Soviet Union. There was only one person, to my knowledge, which was Boris Zichel, who was a director of the Institute for Philosophy in those days, who actually insisted that Soviet Union is a class society. Now, fast forward to 1954, Djilas is actually going to come up with an idea that in many ways echoes ideas of anarchists, more than Trotskyists. And he's going to say in his famous Anatomy of a Morale, which was the first critique of Yugoslav, in his own thick journal, by the way, which was called Our Ideas, Naše Ideje, first criticism of Yugoslav bureaucracy, not only Soviet bureaucracy, but Yugoslav bureaucracy as a new class. And he is also going to use, although he did use this term in 1949 as well, he is going to say that Soviet Union was a state capitalist country, which was in those days huge. Edvard Kardelj did not go that far. Kardelj, again, the founder of Yugoslav self-management, he was closer to the degenerate, deformed theory of bureaucracy in Soviet Union as something that's more transitory and
which
so
is the
forth.
Trotskyist.
Exactly. He echoed more Trotskyist analysis, although, of course, they distanced themselves from Trotsky. But in any case, this is sometimes known as the return to Marx, this period between 1948 and 1950. I think it's a wrong way to approach it. I think a better way would be return to Marx and Lenin and certain kinds of Marx and Lenin. What they read was Marx's criticism of Paris Commune, again, very much influenced by the anarchist thought, and Lenin's State and Revolution, which provided actually an excellent foundational critique and possibility to analyze and criticize Soviet bureaucracy. But this effort, which was a serious theoretical effort of purging Stalinism from theoretical analysis, left a great imprint on the consciousness of young intellectuals who were mostly philosophers and who are going through a series of thick journals emerge into a collective, of which the most famous instance between 1964 and 1975, their final demise, is going to be a journal called Praxis. It was much more than a journal. It was an organization of intellectuals that finally congealed in that period of time. But that was before that. Let me just go to 1950, what might be called the third stage of the Yugoslav Revolution, when there was something that attracted the attention of the entire world. I mean, it's difficult for me to even try to conjure the enthusiasm around which the announcement of Yugoslav self-management, which arrived in 1950s, it exploded. It was a full-blown alternative to Stalinism, which is losing all the credibility among at least more libertarian-minded communists and Marxists of that period. 1950 is the Yugoslav announcements of self-management, followed by, people sometimes forget, 1952 massive reorganization of Yugoslav Communist Party. And Yugoslav Communist Party announced something that became a contradiction that's going to follow the history of Yugoslav Communist Party until the very end. They said something like this: Yugoslavs, communists, and the party itself is not here to command. It's here to lead by persuasion and by example. Now, of course, this was related to self-management, but it created this fundamental contradiction in which Yugoslav communists, which became the League of Yugoslav Communists, that was the new name of the organization, were at the same time a Bolshevik party that later in the same document called itself responsible for protecting the unity and will of theory and practice, it's classic Bolshevik language, but at the same time facilitating the process of self-management that belongs to workers themselves, and now this is interesting, extend to the society as a whole. So Yugoslav experience is, now we are entering this third phase, was truly remarkable in that way. But the most interesting thing, I think, was that this distancing from Stalinism, from Diamat, which was quite clumsy at the beginning, was then left to this new group of university intellectuals who called themselves philosophers and who used philosophy as a new way of organizing the institution of political critique in Yugoslav society. And their relationship with Yugoslav bureaucracy created this dynamic interplay that made Yugoslav socialism as popular as it was among many thinkers on the left.
I'm speaking with anarchist educator Andrej Gribicic, originally from the former Yugoslavia, and we're talking about the radical traditions of the former Yugoslavia and of Yugoslav socialism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We'll explain what self-management actually meant in Yugoslavia. What were the ideas that it drew from? What traditions did it draw from? And what did it look like on the ground?
It was an incredible experiment. It went back and forth between this, trapped in this contradiction, between a political party that, and you have to remember, there was just a step away from saying Soviet Union became a bureaucratic society, all Yugoslavs agreed with that, because of the political party. And then saying Yugoslavia is trying to debureaucratize while keeping the political party, influencing, coordinating, but not commanding. So Yugoslav self-management is exactly this. And Edvard Karderi was lucky enough to be privy to certain documents that went into his own thinking about this, was the official party theorist. And we can, you know, make a certain distinction between the official party thought and between the thought of young philosophers who are like Rudi Supek and Gajo Petrovic and Mihailo Marković, Ljubomir Tadić, who are later going to become the main people in Korčula school, in Praxis, and all of this wonderful Yugoslav dissident experiences. But the official thought included return to Marx and Lenin, that I already mentioned, as a theoretical influence, included someone clandestine reading on the side of Kardel of the anarcho-syndicalist experience in Spain, and also of the English thoughts on guild socialism. Of course, there was an element of reading Trotsky and his criticism of bureaucracy, but really the idea of self-management was something that was developed by Kardel and Yugoslav communists, the official thought of the Yugoslav communist bureaucracy. But later on, in dialogue with this group of philosophers who called themselves Praxis and who were probably the principal and most interesting critics of Yugoslav bureaucracy. And that created this fascinating and somewhat semi-incestuous dynamism that propelled Yugoslav socialism forward. Because for the Praxis journal and people who eventually became part of the Praxis experience, the key element was actually not going back to Marx and Lenin, but defeating the materialist, the Diamat interpretation of history, according to which we see a difference between young Marx, who is naive, who likes philosophizing, who is humanist, and then serious scientist Marx, who writes serious things. And of course, one is juvenile, the other phase is more mature. They said, no, absolutely not, rubbish. Young Marx, and the key word in all of this is alienation. Alienation and young Marx are the way for us to rethink the experience not only of capitalist society, but also of the unfinished socialist revolution. And, you know, we can go back to 18th Brumaire and Marx and his own thoughts and, you know, optimism in thinking about something along the lines of permanent revolution that will consider, he used to say, we have to, communists after the war, after the revolution, after the victory, will have to interrupt themselves. They will have to criticize themselves. That's the important element of self-criticism that many people forget about. Marx actually did speak about self-criticism and permanent revolution through self-criticism. And this was picked up by this group of philosophers who said, well, and this was, I think, the initial issue of Praxis, the journal, they said, well, we are philosophers, and philosophy for us is revolution. Philosophical thought is revolutionary thought. Philosophical thought, I'm paraphrasing, serves to continue and complete the revolution. And it is about critique, merciless critique, about everything that exists. And that was, of course, a nod to Marx and his idea of creative criticism, and also Marx's famous notes that we should not be afraid in our ruthless criticism of everything that exists, of the ultimate conclusions of our critique, and also of the critique itself in the way that it influences those in power. And that relationship between the young philosophers and the Yugoslav bureaucracy created this incredible dynamism. But important thing is to say, and this is bringing us back to the theory of libertarian communism and libertarian socialism, they did not do that in the vacuum. Yugoslav philosophers around many different, around Pogledi, which is View, thick journal called View, then Naše Misli, Our Thoughts, another thick journal, and finally Praxis, the last of the thick journals, created a bridge between Eastern, Southern, and Western philosophers of libertarian Marxism. So when Praxis called the first meeting in Korčula, which is an island in Croatia, on the meaning and content of and perspectives of socialism, which was attended by, and listen to this group, Marcuse,
Herbert Marcuse,
Ernst Bloch, Mallet, who was involved in a fascinating conversation with Marcuse over the content of socialism in the industrialized countries, all the Yugoslav members of Praxis, Erich Fromm, Annie Lefebvre. So all of these, and of, I should probably not forget, Karel Kosik and people, other people in Eastern Europe, that was really going back to that humanist Marx who thought about alienation and who thought about communism as a process that dissolves, that is an anti-state revolution, is really something that brought together people from Praxis, Praxis Group, and people from all over, really, the Western world at least, who were critical of official Marxism.
So people from the Frankfurt School, and I guess broadly described, this would be the moment of Marxist humanism when these conversations were going on. But obviously this wasn't just a question of philosophy, in that some of these ideas anyway were being considered, critiqued in real life, in the context of Yugoslav socialism. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of how this played out for the working class in Yugoslavia, what did self-management look like for them?
Well, I'm going to be boring and insist on one thing. Philosophy, in according to Praxis, but also in many of the Eastern European countries, is not considered to be something that's outside of the experience. It's considered to be a revolutionary act. The idea is to basically dissolve the need for any alienated professional activity, including that of the intellectual. So the idea is to be dogmatic in anti-dogmatism. An idea is to be professional intellectuals or communist intellectuals who are dissolving themselves into the universal consciousness of the working class. So that was the idea. So philosophy in that sense is primarily a political, that's why Praxis, demystification of practice, of theory that leads to demystification of praxis, also leads to some very concrete proposals. Mihailo Markovic's proposal on informational centers that would aid workers in making economic decisions, study groups on the different levels of making economic decisions in self-management, his idea of university as and factories as the self-managed atoms of the new socialist and complete socialist society. So all of these things were ultimately extremely political, especially in their circumstances, and they did affect workers a great deal. Now, workers were tremendously empowered by the institution of self-management. And by institution of self-management, I'm referring primarily to the popular assemblies and the way that workplaces have been organized. Now, this is not a naive, apologetic look at what everything that was wonderful in Yugoslav socialism, because I already tried to explain that there was a particular dialectic between libertarian content and bureaucratic content of Yugoslav revolution that made it for this specifically Yugoslav experience that's so different than any other Eastern European socialist experience. And what is so interesting about this is that empowerment was genuine, and people actually felt that they're making decisions, and often through a conflict with the managers and people in the party who actually created conditions for them to feel empowered in the first place. I mean, this is just a game of wonderful paradoxes and contradictions. Ljubljana program. Ljubljana is the capital of Slovenia, of League of Communist Revolutionaries, announced very boldly very boldly that the role of Yugoslav communists in 1958, that was the great opening, was to become a creative force in socialism, to destroy all the idols. Nothing was sacred. The party needs to become completely debureaucratized, they said, and socialism needs to become something completely new and to transcend itself because new form has not been found. So all of this thinking, which was, of course, really difficult to implement in practice, but nevertheless they did. So workers at the same time were in power and they were at the same time rebelling against the power.
Because of time, we're not going to be able to explore the really fascinating aspect of the role of socialist Yugoslavia and the non-aligned movement as an alternative to both the capitalist world and the Soviet world and that fascinating story. But just staying with this experiment in self-management, what role did the market play in self-management in the Yugoslav socialist model? And at what point did the tensions of that become apparent, particularly into the 1970s?
Throughout. I think it was a dialectical relationship between, again, debureaucratized, genuine, libertarian, directly democratic elements, movements, strikes, and on the other hand, pushes from the more bureaucratic, the official Yugoslav Communist Party or Yugoslav Communists. There were periods of opening and periods of closing. There were different phases in which you can influence the political party in a way that was tremendous. And even they, the Yugoslav bureaucracy, admitted that they have been pushed to change their opinion on numerous. And let me just say that one of the things that is the great and most painful paradox of Yugoslav experience that nobody seems to want to talk about is that Yugoslav, this libertarian thrust of Yugoslav revolutionary experience, both the official and the dissident share the same common revolutionary heritage and their affinity and their devotion to development of socialist Yugoslavia. And there is a relationship between them. And the more the dissidents were pushing and influencing the Communist Party, which exploded in 1968. 1968 was this tremendous event in Yugoslavia that went very differently than in Czechoslovakia and Soviet Union, where it was crushed. In Yugoslavia, it was actually successful. And many of the ideas of the humanist Marxism of Praxis were actually integrated into the constitutional amendments of 1970, 1971 and 2, and finally the new constitution of 1974, which created decentralization of Yugoslav republics, six republics, two provinces, and made Yugoslavia very decentralized and very anti-authoritarian in many ways, which created the seeds for eventual dissolution of Yugoslavia, because the provincial communist parties in the different republics gained more power, gained more autonomy, and this eventually, in a terrible paradox, eroded the Yugoslav sense of unity and led to decentralization that would lead to the actual dissolution. So the relative success of Yugoslav 1968, even though Praxis themselves were dismantled and prosecuted after 1975, actually did lead in a successful way to a terrible result of the demise of Yugoslavia.
Let me just end by asking you about life before the breakup of Yugoslavia. The breakup of Yugoslavia is its own, probably full hour at least, program. And as you've noted, the seeds of it, paradoxically, could be traced to these policies. But because the Yugoslav socialist experience was so very distinct to that of the other Eastern European Soviet bloc countries, and yet in the United States it's not a story we tend to hear now, people don't really tend to hear much about it, can you just explain the degree to which, for someone growing up in Yugoslavia in the 1980s before the tragic breakup and the horrible wars that followed the breakup of Yugoslavia, But for someone growing up in the 1980s, what was the degree of political and cultural freedom?
Incredible. Truly incredible. And, you know, the idea of creating, we were talking about an attempt to create a new integrated worldview on the side of official thought and dissident thought, they were successful. I mean, it's very difficult for me to admit this in many ways, but, you know, reminiscing, going back to all of these memories and thinking about this, we lived in a different society, a society that was fundamentally different. And even though there, you know, one can easily dismiss many of these differences, but we lived in a society that never existed before and that have not existed since. We had that experience since 1950s and the openings of 1950s up until, unfortunately, very recently. And that experience was something that my grandparents did build. And I say this, it's a bittersweet statement. They were almost successful. Living in the 80s, being exposed to American and all other Western influences, to the Russian influences, Soviet influences, to the Yugoslav indigenous developments, to living theater shows at Bitev Teatr in Belgrade, to Tina Turner's concerts, to go to a more kitschy version of all of that, to beautiful Czech surrealist films that we used to watch. That kind of freedom, despite all of the restrictions, creates something in you. And this idea of creating a new society, creating new people, creating what we used to call new morality, not bourgeois morality, communist morality, was to such a degree successful that it truly pains me when I hear all of my erstwhile comrades saying that this was just a passing thing and this was a result of a compromise that could not last, and all of this might have been true, but it was real and we emerged as different people.
Well, just to talk a bit more in depth about that, what was the degree to which you as a young person in the 1980s had access to political dissident notions and ideas? To what degree were you able, because of course our picture of life in the Soviet bloc is one of great surveillance and control of ideas, and these are not just ideas coming from the capitalist world, but radical ideas, ideas from the left. To what degree in socialist Yugoslavia were you able to access radical ideas?
I would walk to my people's library, which is a child library for children, and I would pick up a book translated by Zoran Zinjic, who would to become the first neoliberal prime minister after the war in 2001, I believe, who was at that time a Praxis dissident and translator of Kropotkin. So I would read Kropotkin in a children's public library, and after that I would read Zamyatin, and after that I would read Orwell, and after Bakunin.
Kropotkin being the Russian anarchist geographer, and Zamyatin being the Soviet dissident writer who wrote this book, We, which 1984 borrows liberally from, which is a condemnation of a Stalinist society.
Plagiarizes, but yes. So I was able to read all of these books. And, this is not to say that there was no censorship, but the person who doesn't have patience for nuance and who has penchant for blueprints should not read about Yugoslavia and should probably not listen to this radio show. Yugoslavia was a complicated experience in which we all had access to dissident literature that pushed and transformed many of us who had to listen to Marxism in elementary school, high school, and university as one of the main topics, subjects, classes, turned most of us into, in European sense, libertarians, in people who were close to libertarian socialism, communism, anarchism, and all of these ideas. And this was based on the literature that we read as children. I became a libertarian communist at the age of 13 in public school libraries. So all of this existed in translation. And these are these endless Yugoslav contradictions that were tremendously empowering. And at the same time, of course, they were restricting. And Yugoslavia was by no means a socialist paradise or a model for a full-blown model for a new socialist society. But if people are serious about trying to understand what democratic socialism is, and if they're actually serious about trying to understand what Marxist humanism was, well, they need to go back to Yugoslavia. And those people who would like to understand how they can build self-management, and as Henri Lefebvre said, extended throughout the society, they need to go back to Yugoslavia and to understand that history does not unfold in these neat models, but it's full of contradictions, the contradictions that we need to seize, to explore and to study. And that's why I'm very grateful to you for inviting me to share some of these thoughts and memories.
Andrei, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Andrei Grubicic. He is professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology and Social Change at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He's from the former Yugoslavia, and he's the author, among other books, of Don't Mourn Balkanize, which was published by PM Press. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have a connection to PM Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.